Hello. We face the sharpest and most violent dislocation of our society. We face unprecedented challenges that will determine whether we live out our lives in relative comfort or in the midst of famine, disease, economic collapse and despotism. The end of cheap oil and rapid climate change. Those are the most important issues that you will ever face. Current oil price increases reflects an emerging and permanent supply crisis for oil and gas. Current discovery trends of one barrel for every six used and the decline of 5% output from nine major oil producers point to a situation of peak oil. The first half of the oil age, which was characterized by growing production, is about to be followed by the second half, when oil production is set to decline along with all that depends on it. In this talk today, I want to begin by explaining climate change because our use of carbon-based fuels is leading to a collapse of many of our supply and support systems. I will then return to the question of oil. And finally conclude reflecting on some positive changes that we can make in our own lives, turning threats into positive opportunities. 200 scientists from the IPCC, the International Panel of Climate Change, say that we are facing calamitous change and mass extinction of species if we don't immediately begin reductions in carbon-based fuels. Levels of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere are increasing sharply, with a 64% rise in the rate of growth over the past few years. In the last 100 years, New Zealand's use of energy doubled every 22 years, and our greenhouse emissions increased 22% from 1990 until 2000, and they are still increasing, along with global trends. According to Margot Wallström, the European Commissioner of Environment, Earth has entered a new era, one in which human beings are the dominant force. The uncertainty, magnitude and speed of change in many of the Earth's systems is without precedent since the retreat of the last ice age 15,000 years ago. The northern polar cap has reduced to 40% of its size, and glaciers are in rapid retreat right around the globe. In 2001, NASA scientists concluded that the margins of the Greenland ice sheet were dropping in height at a rate of roughly 1 meter a year. Now, Carl Bogelt and his team have recorded falls as dramatic as 10 meters a year. In places, the ice is dropping at a rate of 1 meter a month. Ice, formed thousands of years ago, is not being replaced. This increases the likelihood of years with low lake levels and future power shortages here in New Zealand. Recent studies of ice cores in Antarctica, led by Professor Jim Kennett, now confirm that only 1 or 2 degrees decrease in southern ocean temperatures could result in massive release of methane hydrate deposits on the bottom of the sea, triggering runaway climate change of 8 degrees over the next decades. Insurance costs are increasing astronomically. The European heatwave and drought cost 35,000 lives and £13 billion. And our own extreme weather this last February cost $300 million. Then there was the July floods in Bay of Plenty. Worldwide rising temperatures and falling water tables have now led to a plateau in grain production. Global production over the last 4 years did not meet the demand. One more poor harvest year and famine becomes inevitable. The US Department of Agriculture has developed a rule of thumb that each 1 degree rise in the ideal growing temperature reduces grain yields by 10%. At the same time, a new global study concludes that 90% of all large fishes have disappeared from the world's oceans in the past half century. The devastating result of industrial fishing. Now to return to the question of oil. The United States consumes a quarter of the world's hydrocarbons. New Zealand is in the same league, with a similar energy use per dollar of GDP. Now, oil is the highest quality energy we use, making up about 38% of world's energy supply. No other energy source equals oil's intrinsic qualities of extractability, transportability, versatility, and cost. Yet, we have squandered 50% of oil supplies in little over half a century. Now, our Earth and Sun are 3,500 million years old, and the Sun is at its half-life. Humans have been on this planet for nearly 1 million of those 3,500 million years. Human civilization, on the other hand, is only 11,000 years old, thanks to the beneficent climate which recently evolved. In 1900, there were few cars, no aircraft, no television. There was no computer in 1900, and no internet. Today, we have immense knowledge of some elements of our ecology, of how pine forests grow, of how birds find their way around the world, and even the rapid extinction of species in past millennia. However, few seem capable of looking at the big picture, the whole ecosystem, the intricate web and interaction of each one of its components, and its possible collapse. In New Zealand, we already had an energy crisis in a country endowed with plentiful water and sunshine. How can this be? The time has come to change course, to put our civilization on another trajectory. In the 1970s, the Muldoon government of that time wrote contracts with Shell BP Todd, allowing for the depletion of all Maui gas within 30 years at a fixed cheap price. Thus, we have been exporting 45% in the form of Methanex, burning another 45% in thermal power stations, a process that wastes half the energy component of the fuel. Only 5% has been used domestically in its natural form, in spite of pleas from environmentalists. So, did we plan for the demise of Maui gas? No. Yes, we do have an Energy Efficiency and Conservation Act, an Energy Efficiency Strategy, a Land Transport Act, and a Local Body Act which emphasise sustainability. However, compare the $1.4 million increase the government doled out to ECA, the Energy Efficiency Conservation Authority, in this last year's budget, with Meridian Energy's special dividend of $100 million, and compare that with the $1.2 billion Aquahydro project, fortunately canned. And now take note of the artificial low price that Maui gas was sold to the thermal power stations and the impact on investment in renewables over the last decades. Investment in renewables has been inhibited to a degree unprecedented in any other Western country. This is in spite of New Zealand's uniquely favourable physical resources and also grossly inefficient energy use in houses, commercial premises and industry. Compare New Zealand's strategy with that of Germany, where the government guaranteed a minimum price for renewables a decade ago, resulting in installed wind power generation now exceeding New Zealand's total electricity consumption. But at the same time, they maintained a zero growth in overall energy usage. Worldwide, wind power has been increasing at 30 to 40% every year. Compare that with the recent Australian Solar Cities initiative that makes mandatory energy rating of new firms, and California, where half of all new homes are to be running on solar energy in 10 years. We need to copy some of these initiatives overseas. Last year, the government announced a new Crown Electricity Governance Board to ensure reserve capacity coverage for dry years and hydro generation. Does this solve any of our problems? No, a new oil-fired power station was built. This decision does nothing to address real needs, needs which can be resolved through innovations, efficiencies, and demand-side management. More importantly, improving the efficiency of electricity use is typically half or less the cost of new power generation. Unfortunately, most businesses and householders can't figure out what solution is best for them. If electricity demand continues to grow at 5% a year, we have to double the whole system in 14 years. This is a path to disaster that is as predictable as Maui depletion was 30 years ago. The government must take the opportunity to plan the decommissioning of coal, oil and gas-fired power plants and map out a switch to solar power, solar cities and conservation and deficiencies. Only a few months ago, the government agreed to underwrite the construction of a gas turbine station at Huntly, as it cannot guarantee Genesis Energy long-term gas contracts to ensure commercial viability. Mighty River announced a proposal to convert the mothball power plant south of Whangarei from oil to coal. Yet, in a recent budget debate, Michael Cullen acknowledged that oil will never be cheap again, and also that the government supports energy initiatives, yet we are supporting billions on new motorways and supporting coal and gas-fired power stations. Will the infrastructure for energy-efficient public transport and rail be built before the price of oil makes its construction prohibitively expensive? As Jeanette Fitzsimons said, this year's budget was another missed opportunity to change course in a number of directions. Those like Fran Wild, recently elected to the Regional Council, advocate further spending of $450 million on Wellington roads, and these people will need to be held accountable in the future. Just now, looking again at the oil question, the price of crude oil passed $50 a barrel a number of months ago. This was twice the MED prediction 10 months ago of $20. It is more than twice the prediction of $19 per barrel on which this year's budget was based. The recent price rises are about demand. That rising demand is against a background of gradual depletion. US oil fields passed their peak and have declined since 1970. New Zealand oil fields passed their peak around 1986 and have declined steeply since. Despite pledges to increase its output, Saudi Arabia, OPEC's largest producer and exporter, produced only 9.13 million barrels a day of oil in July, and that was down from 9.5 million barrels a day in June. Output from 50 countries is declining, and the rate of decline is accelerating, with leading geologists now predicting peak oil before 2007 and 8, if it hasn't already done so. Global peak oil is the point at which maximum global production of oil is reached. The production curve looks like a bell curve. Once at the top of the curve, we move into downside. On the downside, it becomes more expensive and less productive to pump oil out of the ground. Prior experience in the US, peak in 1971, the UK, peak in 1999, Australia, peak 2000, verifies this trend. The world is currently near the peak of global oil production. And oil is important. Just look around you. What hasn't got a cheap oil component? The synthetic bag, those shoes, computer bodies require the same amount of energy to mine, process, and supply the materials as for a car. And that is equivalent to the fuel you might use over the car's lifetime. Goods in the supermarket, imported, flown from the other side of the world. The food-producing industry itself uses about 10 calories of fossil fuel energy for every calorie of food energy. And that doesn't take into account the oil needed to fly that tomato paste from Italy to New Zealand. Yes, it is that jet fuel for aviation and intensive agriculture that will be affected first, leading to decreased tourism and steep price rises in imports and food prices. It is also not generally understood that poorer quality energy sources can be critically dependent upon oil for their extraction, processing and distribution. In other words, oil is the precursor for other sources of energy, gas, coal, nuclear, solar, hydro, because these require oil fuel to create and maintain infrastructure. It also gives them the illusion of being profitable. George W. Bush and his oily friends are preparing for the approaching night by extending their military might throughout the world into Afghanistan, into Iraq, Colombia, Nigeria, meanwhile instituting a police state at home. To conclude, The world is facing a single underlying systemic problem rather than a lot of totally independent ones. Global warming, the over-exploitation of natural resources, and the extremes of wealth and poverty are the products of an economic system. As a result, any attempt to cure, say, the debt crisis or peak oil by itself, without changing the way the global economy works, is bound to fail. Little publicity has been given to contraction and convergence, which addresses the need for the transfer of wealth along with the depletion of oil and the destructive impact on our climate of greenhouse emissions. Contraction and convergence works through the mechanisms of allocating emission rights, greenhouse emission rights. The scheme makes the right to emit carbon dioxide a basic human right, with emission permits issued to all humankind on an equal basis. This results in a system called contraction and convergence. A number of things can be noted about this. One is that since emission rights are human rights, the permits go to individuals, not to their governments, which merely oversee their distribution. The intention is to keep the purchasing power the permits represent out of the hands of the corrupt elites. An international agency issues the permits, and there is a team of monitors. The emission permits go only to adults, and in fact amount to a global citizen's income. As oil becomes scarce, its price rises, and this will increase the cost of everything everybody buys, including food. Lower consuming people will then have emission permits to sell, and those with too much money will be forced to transfer some of their wealth to them. The value of these emission rights will decrease in a planned way, with the ultimate aim of reducing them to a minimal level. Practical solutions to the multiple threats facing the globe are scarce, and we are dithering, while the magnitude and speed of change in many of the Earth's systems is without precedent. We must consider a fundamental transformation of our society to reduce our dependence on fossil fuels, on oil, and we must have a people-centred approach which combines ecological wisdom with social responsibility and appropriate decision-making. I would like to tell you that we can lead freer, healthier, more fulfilling lives with small-scale economies, with technologies powered by renewable energy delivered by cooperative enterprises, with communities structured to be self-sufficient, tied together by light rail and trolley buses, with gardens and parks in our cities, with social halls, not shopping malls, conservation, integrated transport systems, solar cities, smart energy, and clean heat. Thank you.